EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation.
The EMS Garage is a production of EMSradio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got the DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
This episode of the EMS Garage is brought to you by Children's Hospital Colorado. To learn more information about Children's Hospital and their EMS programs, go to www.childrenscolorado.org.
We are really pleased to have an outside speaker this year from Denver Health again. As you know, we don't deliver babies here yet. And so when we start talking about OB, there's not a lot of expertise within this hospital. But we've always felt like it's important to have some sort of OB lecture at this conference. It's part of your National Registry Continuing Education and Colorado Continuing Education, and it's also just good stuff to know. So I was very pleased when I asked Dr. Chris Caldwell, the Director of Emergency Medicine over at Denver Health, and who has been involved with the Denver Paramedic Division and Denver Fire for maybe more than 12 years now, to please present his trauma and pregnancy lecture, and he thankfully agreed. So. Have a wonderful morning, and I'm going to let Dr. Caldwell get started. Thanks, Chris, for coming.
Good morning. And now, does that work? Everybody here? Is that coming across okay? All right. Well, thank you very much for having me. I know we're having a little trouble with this slide, and it's going to be a little hard. I guess you've got this whole side of the room. But anyway, while they're working on that, thank you for having me. Good morning. Thank you particularly to Jason and Stephanie for the invite. This is a wonderful opportunity for me, and I appreciate everybody coming early this morning to get to. I will try to keep you awake for the first lecture, and I think at least if you wait till the last slide or second last slide, then I will be able to wake you up if you're not already there. And I do want to point out the irony of starting off the day in a pediatric conference talking about a topic where unless things go horribly wrong, you're not going to see the kid at all, right? I mean, the whole point here is to avoid seeing the kid, unless mom's a kid. Mom's sometimes 14, 15, 16. They're kids in many ways. So you have to deal with mom. But the idea here is to avoid seeing the kid. And we're going to talk about ways to do that. This is actually one of my favorite subjects to talk about because as anxiety-provoking as it can be, it's really most of this is pretty simple and pretty straightforward. There's a few things we have to know. There's a few things we have to be aware of, and there's a couple times we're really going to have to act. And even then, although it's certainly not simple, pretty straightforward what's going to have to happen. So I like taking a potentially complicated and difficult subject and putting it into relatively simple terms, and trauma and pregnancy does exactly that. So let's see. We still don't seem to be having this slide part of things, but, well, now we've got all that one off too. But for this, let's talk about the case. I'll just go ahead and tell you what this is. 28-year-old female. This is a case that I saw relatively recently. 28-year-old female who is about 7 months pregnant. She can't give you a lot more than that. She thinks she's 7 months. Sees her OB most of the time when she's supposed to, but last felt to be about 7 months. And she was a restrained driver in a major mechanism motor vehicle accident. She actually was, head-on, she turned the last minute, for this pickup truck who hit her, what ultimately turned out to be on the passenger side, but pretty significant, about 45, 50 miles an hour, pretty significant mechanism. She's got some neck and back pain, and then when you ask, she says, well, you know what? I'm not feeling the baby move. I usually feel the baby move this time in the morning, and I'm not feeling the baby move. Yes, sir?
That's okay. Your speaker's going in and out.
The speaker is? I wonder. It is working now? Okay. And we're getting these slides. They're going to come. By the end of this talk, they'll be going. all right. So she's not feeling the baby move all that well. And you get to take her vital signs, and her pulse is 120, and her blood pressure is 94 over 62. Okay, so you can picture this. Imagine yourself in that scenario. We'll come back to this. Okay, a little bit on trauma in pregnancy. Trauma makes up about 6 to 7% of all pregnancies. About half, a little over half, are motor vehicle accidents, but a reasonable number here are falls, and unfortunately a reasonable number are assaults as well. And you'll get some burns in there. But almost, in some places, up to 10% of pregnancies involve trauma that ultimately has to be seen at the hospital. And this doesn't include the trauma that never gets seen. Now, you'll hear this statement, and I just want to address this right up front. So the number one cause of fetal mortality is maternal mortality, right? You've heard that? Okay, that's really not true. I hate to kind of take away these statements that we all hold as true for our entire medical career, but that is not true. The number one cause of fetal mortality is placental abruption. Now, I like this statement. I think we can keep this statement in our minds because it is very true. Maternal mortality is really, really bad for the fetus, and the only thing that we can do in that situation is take care of the mom. So I like the idea behind this, and if you remember this and remember it as that, that's fine. But I also want you to remember that the number one cause of fetal mortality is placental abruption. And the reason for that is most cases of placental abruption, mom looks fine. So if we think maternal mortality is the only thing I really got to worry about, we're going to have some misconceptions about dealing with trauma and pregnancy. So remember both. Remember that maternal mortality is really bad and that placental abruption is number one cause of fetal mortality, and mom can look really good in placental abruption. All right. 8% of women between the ages of 15 to 40 that you are going to bring to a trauma center are pregnant. Even the ones that don't know they're pregnant. Even the ones who can't be pregnant. And I will tell you this, 2012 is going to be an amazing year. I know this because I have had 8 immaculate conceptions in 2012 alone that I've taken care of. And it gets to the point, and one of them, at least with trauma, this was last year, not this year, was at 40 weeks and an immaculate conception. It's amazing what can happen. But I don't want to ever leave the message that we don't trust our patients. I don't want to ever leave the message that they are going to lie to us or they're not going to be totally upfront with us. But I do want to leave the message that we must assume they are pregnant. If they are of childbearing age, and what's childbearing age? This was just the literature that shows us 8% are going to be between 15 and 40 are pregnant. That's not childbearing age. What's childbearing age? 12 to 57. I like that. Some places get down as low as 10. That's a little tough, but certainly, and I've seen 55. I haven't seen 57 yet, but I think if in that range, you got to consider the possibility that they're pregnant. So just think about it. Again, we're not distrusting our patients. We're just saying numbers would suggest we've got to assume they're pregnant. All right, let's talk about physiology. Now, before I give a talk, I always impose upon my wife. I give her the talk in front of it so she can kind of get a sense of, no, that doesn't make any sense, doesn't sound right. And I put up this slide, and I've never been pregnant. She has. And she said right away, your slide is wrong. Physiology implies something's normal, because physiology is normal, right? You should put pathophysiology. Pregnancy is a disease state. I'm not going to argue with her. So I will change this slide next time. She told me this last night. It's too late to change it. But the pathophysiology of pregnancy begins in the first trimester, even before you're going to notice any other changes of pregnancy. Why? Because the body's already getting ready for childbirth. Right, is starting to prepare for the massive blood loss of childbirth and how it's going to react to that. So blood volume is going to increase by 50%. They're going to have twice as much blood volume up to by the time they are ready to deliver as they had before they were pregnant. Now, for a variety of reasons, it's actually a dilutional increase in blood volume. So the hematocrit levels go down a little bit. And that's important when we start talking about oxygen carrying capacity. But the blood volume is up dramatically. Cardiac output increases by about 50%. Most of that's going to the uterus. 600 cc's per minute is going to the uterus in the normal state. Now, when you start bleeding, when she starts bleeding, it's going to start to try to stop that. But right now, we've got, in about 8 to 10 minutes, the entire blood volume of mom's body is going to go through her uterus. So you can imagine what happens when you have injuries to the uterus and what potential blood loss is going to occur. And again, everything about the body is going to try to change that. It's going to try to reduce the blood flow to the uterus. Hence, the fetus is going to be in trouble. But an enormous amount of blood is going to go through the uterus. So we've got to remember that. And remember that things like abruption, things like even other types of bleeding or other reasons for bleeding can be very significant in pregnancy. All right, more pathophysiology. There's marked venous congestion within the pelvis and within the lower extremities during pregnancy. And the further along you go, the more the congestion is going to be. What does that mean? It means even relatively minor trauma to the pelvis and legs can result in a lot of blood loss. So please keep that in mind. In almost two-thirds of that entire blood volume that now has increased dramatically is in the lower half of the body. So trauma to any of that area is going to be potentially very significant. One of our attendings who was in fact pregnant during these pictures and agreed to model. So we've got blood pressure is going to be lower during pregnancy by about 5 to 15 millimeters of mercury. And this is peaking at 28 weeks. Now, we've all seen that, right? I mean, again, I can use my wife as an example. She walks around now with a blood pressure. She's not pregnant, about 92. I hope she's not pregnant. I don't think she's pregnant. But she's about 92 or so normal. When she was at 28 weeks, she was walking around with blood pressure about 74. And that was her normal blood pressure. Now, you can see where we're going with this. But because of decreased systemic vascular resistance is really the reason why this is happening. But a normal blood pressure is going to be very low, particularly once you get up to the point of about 28 weeks. And the heart rate's going up. Now, there's a few reasons for this. One is the increased blood volume, but another is they actually have got estrogen-mediated myocardial alpha receptors that are increased dramatically during pregnancy. So it's understandable that they're going to have a higher heart rate. And in fact, a normal heart rate in pregnancy can be in the 80s, 90s, and even the low 100s. So before your patient has even undergone any trauma at all, they've woken up in the morning, everything is normal, they can have a pulse of 100 and a pressure of 80. So you can imagine how it's going to be. I mean, normally if I give you a trauma patient with a pulse of 100 and a pressure of 80, we're worried. And probably should be. And I'm certainly not suggesting we shouldn't be worried about this, but that could be their normal vital signs right off the bat. And here's the other scary part for this, is that maternal circulation is always going to be maintained at the risk of the fetus. The body knows so much more than we ever will. And it figured it out real quickly. If the mom doesn't survive, baby's not going to have any chance. So everything I'm going to do as the body, the human body, is going to be trying to preserve mom's circulation, even if I have to sacrifice baby circulation to do it. So I'm going to maintain those vital signs, those already abnormal vital signs, at all expenses. And you can see mom with what is going to be relatively normal vital signs for pregnancy and have all of that impact on the fetus and fetus circulation dramatically impaired. So, take home point, mom can lose up to 30% of her blood volume, a third of the blood that she has in her system, and she's going to maintain what are going to be for her normal vital signs. And we've got to recognize that when we're managing these patients. We cannot wait for truly abnormal vital signs to realize something very bad can be happening. Okay, more pathophysiology. So respiratory. Increased metabolic demands. We've got now two bodies that are needing these metabolic requirements. So you're going to have increased oxygen consumption, increased ventilation. That's mostly because of increased tidal volume. And the diaphragm's going to move up, mostly to accommodate this bigger and bigger uterus. And that's going to decrease your functional residual capacity. What does all that mean? I mean, pulmonologists love to talk about that kind of stuff, but what it really means for us is mom's reserve is down. mom's going to get hypoxic really quickly. And if mom gets hypoxic, in fact, by the time mom gets hypoxic, baby's already hypoxic. So right off the bat, we have to recognize that, and we have to recognize that oxygen therapy is going to be helpful, even in a setting where mom doesn't seem to be in distress and is not yet hypoxemic. When you get a pulse oximetry that's starting to go down, it's already late. Because we know by then the blood oxygen and blood is already down, and we've already talked about the carrying capacity is less, right? So already fetus is going to be feeling this and feeling it hard, even before mom, you start to see any real signs in mom. What all of those pathophysiologic processes result in is a respiratory alkalosis, which means, again, mom's going to be real prone to rapid desaturation. And in fact, things like anything going on in the lungs, pulmonary contusions, pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, is going to get a lot worse much more quickly. So please be aware of that. The respiratory status is very tenuous to begin with, and now we're going to introduce trauma, which is going to make it worse. They're at increased risk for aspiration. They have decreased gastric motility. The lower esophageal sphincter tone is weakened. So they're going to be at increased risk for aspiration. Here's a big one for us. So at as early as 20 weeks, the uterus is going to completely compress the vena cava when you lie them flat. So we've always heard this, but it's easy to forget, particularly when they're not huge and pregnant, is that when we lie them on their back, they're going to compress the vena cava. And if you don't believe that, I've got proof. I'll show you proof from one of my own patients. So realize that even as early as 20 weeks, this can happen. And when this happens, when we compress the vena cava, we reduce cardiac output by up to 30%. So what's the flip side of that? You can increase cardiac output by up to 30% by moving them on their side. Also, remember this as well, that even as early as 20 weeks, I haven't seen this come in earlier. They say it's possible. I haven't seen it. But as early as 20 weeks, eclampsia can set in, which is scary because what's the treatment for eclampsia? It's delivering the baby. And at 20 weeks, that's dicey. But realize that. So when you run into a situation where you've had a single car motor vehicle accident or something strange has happened that you can't understand this trauma, think about that. Even as early as 20 weeks, eclampsia. And what is eclampsia? Eclampsia is preeclampsia, which is hypertension, protein in the urine, all those things, and a seizure. So somebody who doesn't have any history of seizures, no reason to seize, hasn't had any trauma that you can tell, but something weird has happened, like they've had single car rolled off the side of the road, doesn't make any sense, think about this. Eclampsia can be as early as 20 weeks. Okay. So what is viable, right? I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. We always have to think about the two patients, but we're only dealing with one. We can only see one. So at what point do we have a viable fetus? You get a lot of debate about this, and I went through literature again earlier this week to see if anybody came up with a better answer, and they have not. The answers you hear are between 20 and 24 weeks. I haven't seen anybody go below 20 as being viable. And I really haven't seen anybody delve into much above 22, certainly not above 24. So what does that mean to you? Probably about 22 weeks. Now, I've already said ages are going to be tough. And a lot of times, I mean, sometimes they can say, I just saw my OB yesterday after 20 weeks. Sometimes they're at every week or every other week visits. So they can sometimes give you, I am 20 weeks, 3 3/7 days. But more often than not, they're going to say, I'm about 6 months, 7 months. And actually, you can figure this out fairly easily yourself. So, 2 finger breadths above the umbilicus. If your uterus is 2 finger breadths above the umbilicus, they're viable, as far as you're concerned. Now, some would consider at the umbilicus viable, so you probably ought to err on that side. But there's no question in my mind that if you can see, get 2 finger breadths above the umbilicus, they're viable. And you are now dealing with 2 viable patients, and you've got to think about that. A 16-week it's been through some trauma, it's still serious, but in terms of being sure that they're going to a place that can manage OB is not as much of an issue as any time you are worried about a viable fetus. And you can figure that out whether they know their dates or not, whether they even know they're pregnant or not. Okay, so the gravid uterus, once you start to see it, once you really start to see it, we're probably at least in the 12 weeks and well beyond that. Before that, inside of 12 weeks, it's hidden and protected very well by the pelvis. Now at 12 weeks, it's starting to come up out of the pelvis. Now that can be, that's a good and a bad thing. It's good in that it protects the intra-abdominal organs relatively well. The spleen, the liver, the uterus actually protects it very well, but because it takes the brunt of the trauma. So you've got to worry more about things like direct trauma of the fetus, placental abruption, bladder injuries, bowel injuries, particularly penetrating trauma, stab wounds to the abdomen. Wonderful as those are, big risk for bowel injuries because we push the bowel now up and out. So higher risk for some things, a little bit lower risk for others, but we need to be aware, again, that bladder is right out there in front, bowel is right out there in front, lots of risk where you might not be as concerned otherwise. Okay, now, fetal heart tones. I realize for the most part we're not getting those in the ambulance. If we're doing critical care, some of us have some ultrasound machines out there. For the most part, we're not doing this. If you do have access to it, it's very helpful. Normal is going to be in the 120 to 160 range for any time they're pregnant. And you can start getting Dopplers. If you do have access to ultrasound or you're in a situation where somebody has access to ultrasound, you can start getting Dopplers. It's not hard to do. I could teach you how to do it in about 5 minutes. Some of you already know how to do that. But you can get it about 14 weeks. And if you can get it in any sort of situation, you're transferring somebody out of a place that has it, you have it yourself, it's very valuable because what we talked about before, mom won't show you this, but the fetus will. If the fetus is in trouble, they will give you a sense, they will give you this sign. And it can be fetal tachycardia or fetal bradycardia. Higher than 160 or lower than 120 may be your earliest sign that there's a problem. And the baby will tell you this before mom does. You can get V2V variability if you've got that, basically cardiotocographic monitoring, recurrent decelerations. Those are the type of things that we worry a lot about when we have them in the center. And this is really the gold standard. And the reason I talked to you about here is because we're not going to do this in the field, certainly. But cardiotocographic monitoring is the gold standard for managing viable pregnancy patients. And it is very reasonable for you to expect a center you're bringing your pregnant trauma patient to have this available, have it available in the ED, and if you give them any sort of heads up, have it available for you on your arrival. This is how we're going to monitor a pregnant trauma patient. Should be continuous. Should start early, because this is the only way we're going to catch early injuries. And there aren't very many things that are 100% in medicine. But this is it. If you've got normal cardiotropographic monitoring of the fetus, it's 100% negative predictive value for adverse outcomes. In other words, you're not going to have any problems with the fetus if you can get 4 hours of continuous monitoring here. This is the gold standard. This is what has to be done. If it can't be done, you're not going to be able to take care of these patients. And it's very reasonable for you as the EMS providers to expect this to happen for your patients on arrival to the ED. Now, here's where we get into some of the scary parts of managing these patients. So as the peritoneum stretches, as it gets bigger, it becomes less sensitive. So you have a desensitized peritoneum. That means you can palpate the belly and they're not necessarily going to have the same pain that they would otherwise. Blood is a peritoneal irritant, so normally blood is going to cause abdominal pain, and yet here it may not. Fetal movement, unfortunately, we talked about our case that we started off with, and she says, I'm not feeling the baby movement. That gets everybody a little anxious. And it probably should, except that we know over and over, the studies have shown us that's not very sensitive. Sometimes they're feeling the baby move, and in fact, you're in a very dangerous situation. Other times they're not feeling the baby move, and everything is fine. So you can't hang your hat on that alone. It is worth knowing about, it is worth asking about, and it is another area that we get nervous about, but in fact, it's not going to help you truly decide whether the fetus is at risk or not. All right, so how about our management? We're going to do a few things. We talked about the importance of giving them oxygen, even in a setting of where the patient is not feeling short of breath and is not in any sort of respiratory distress. And the reason is, again, fetal hypoxemia is going to develop way before maternal hypoxemia, and so you're not going to know it until it's too late. So give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, thankfully, most of these patients don't come into that category where we worry about giving them oxygen, right? I mean, we talk about bad cardiac disease and whether or not oxygen might be a little bit dangerous in that. We've always talked about these older COPD patients where oxygen can be a bad thing. In emergency settings, it's not, even in those situations. But we're at a pediatric conference. We're not going to talk about that now. What we are going to talk about is give mom oxygen and give it early. So respiratory status can fall very quickly. Please be aggressive with the sedation. They already can manage a third to a half greater volume than they're used to. It can go far higher than that. So don't worry about sending these patients. The cardiomyopathies of pregnancy are extremely rare. Outside of that setting, they can handle fluids and they can handle it well. Be aggressive. Over and over and over again, the studies have told us that aggressive resuscitation, both with normal saline or lactated ringers in the field and blood on arrival in the emergency department, patients benefit from this. And then place them in the left lateral decubitus position. Now, how do we do it? Some people have asked about, for a variety of ways, how we do this. I'm giving you one example here. You can take the board, turn them up, put some towels under the board. You can put towels or anything, really, under the hip. Move them that way. You can actually, if you want to do this, manually displace the uterus to the left. You can actually push that way. You're not going to cause any harm. And it works to take it off the vena cava. Again, huge increase in cardiac output and improvement in maternal circulation when you do something like this. Now I'm going to put my own personal bias here, and this is where we take this off, say you didn't hear them. Two times I'm going to say you didn't hear it here. This is one of them. And we'll get. And I think you'll understand when I say the other one. For this one, I would say I'm not sure we have ever truly benefited any of our patients with hard boards in the field or in the emergency department, other than transport, other than moving them. But in terms of protecting the spine, I'm not sure we've ever benefited from them. So if you are in a situation where you truly don't feel like you've got a sick trauma patient that's pregnant, and you don't feel like you can reasonably get them in the left lateral decubitus position in a hard board, for God's sake, get rid of the hard board. The benefit is really to you to be able to move this patient. Other than that, in terms of truly protecting the spine, it isn't there. The evidence isn't there. We see all this harm we've done with it. I'm not ready to say change your protocols and stop using hard boards entirely. But if you're in this situation, you really don't feel like you can do it, the hard board is not what's going to save this patient. But getting them into left lateral decubitus can. In a really, truly significant or serious situation, it can be the difference between cardiac arrest and some circulation. It's that serious. So please do be sure you get them in a left lateral decubitus position, anybody beyond 20 weeks. Here is the picture of how it looks. So we've got the aorta here, which is already compressed, inferior vena cava, which doesn't have anywhere near the structure that the inferior vena cava does. That's going to be compressed a lot sooner. And again, if you didn't believe this, here's the CAT scan of my patient, and we do CAT scan trauma patients, and I'll tell you why that is in just a minute. But sometimes, when they need it. But here's the aorta, and here's a completely compressed IVC. She's got absolutely no circulation through her inferior vena cava. Now, she's 33 weeks, but even as early as 20 weeks, that can happen. And again, tell me how that doesn't affect circulation by itself, without any trauma, without anything else. And they know to do this. You won't see too many women after about 20 weeks, certainly after 30 weeks, lying flat on their back. This is why. They're not comfortable with it. They figure it out real quickly, and they move themselves. Now, we take them out of that situation and put them in a situation where we force this compression. You can see where problems will develop, whether or not the trauma is causing a problem as well. All right, I want to talk a little bit about blood, not because we're likely to be doing this in the field, but I think it's important that we understand some of the things that we do early in the emergency department and why. So we're certainly going to get some basic lab tests, CBC, look for that decreased hematocrit, which is already there, but now could be worse. Increased white blood cell count is what you'll see generally. Fibrinogen should be low. Now, why is that important? Well, what it reminds us is that pregnancy, by definition, in order to maintain survival of the species, right? I mean, everything about pregnancy has been going on far longer than we've ever been doing anything about medicine. And all pregnancy and the processes that go along with this is to maintain survival of the baby and of the mom. Now, how are you going to survive during delivery if you don't stop bleeding? You won't. Every delivery would result in death if we couldn't stop bleeding. So right from the very beginning, pregnancy is going to develop into a hypercoagulable state. You're going to be much easier to create clots and to stop bleeding. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't help with pelvic fractures for the reasons that we've talked about and for many others. But everything about this pregnancy state is going to be focused on maintaining fetal and maternal circulation and being a hypercoagulable state getting ready for delivery. AVG, you'll see a base deficit, a natural base deficit when you get below 6. That's worrisome, again, for early management in the emergency department. So what about our management? Now, the one reason we got to talk about some of that, or another reason we got to talk about the respiratory stuff is, with the diaphragm moving up and the decreased residual capacity, if you're going to vent the chest, go high. So normally we're thinking, well, maybe I'm in the fifth or sixth intercostal space down for the mid-axillary line, or if I'm going to go for the mid-clavicular line, I'm going to go second. You can't go much higher than that. But certainly if you're going to go laterally, and I like going laterally if I'm going to vent the chest because it's easier access to the pleural space, go high. You've got your diaphragm way up there. Liver or and or spleen biopsies when you're trying to vent the chest is not a good thing. You want to go high, you want to get in the pleura, and you're going to have to be very high on this one. And again, your goal is to get a patient where they can have early cardiotocographic monitoring. It's pretty simple, two pads on the belly. You've got to have the right machine there to do it. But very quickly, we can tell if the fetus is in any sort of distress. And if the fetus is not, we can almost guarantee mom is not going to be. At least not right now. You've heard about Rogam. I just want to emphasize this. Again, we're not going to check this in the field, obviously. But it's important to understand. An Rh-negative mom who has had even minimal trauma can be sensitized. So the situation that comes up with you is a lot of times they won't know what their blood type is. Some of them will, but many of them won't. And you've seen a patient with minor trauma, and I'm going to try to convince you to bring them all to the hospital anyway, but if you can't, this is still here, that if they are Rh negative and they've been sensitized, their next baby might basically not be able to survive only because we haven't addressed this. Long story short, an Rh negative mom that becomes sensitized, next baby is Rh negative, it will not be compatible. But we have 10 days to potentially treat that, and it can totally eliminate this problem. And so I'm realizing now that we're not only dealing with mom and baby, but we're dealing with a future life that hasn't even been conceived yet, but we can save that too. And if you recognize this problem, it can be so simple as I knocked my belly into a table. That can be enough blood sensitization to cause this problem. So please be aware of that, and please encourage, if you cannot convince them to go to the hospital, please encourage them. They have to be seen soon to make sure what their blood type is, and if it's Rh negative, they need to get Rogam. It's a simple treatment, and it will save a life. So here's what the ultrasound looks like, and this is what, when you bring them into Denver Health, you're going to get very quickly. You're going to get cardiotocographic monitoring for the baby, and you're going to get an ultrasound for the mom. And the reason is this. If it's positive and mom is unstable, it's real easy. They're going to the OR. If it's positive and mom is stable, they're going to CAT scan. And I'll tell you why in just a second. Every time you want to CAT scan a pregnant patient, actually you do. If they are in this situation, you absolutely do. And if it's negative and they're stable, then we can observe them. We don't have to do any of these radiographic studies. So the ultrasound is a wonderful tool to be able to tell us one way or the other. For any of you that are using that in the field, this is something that will tell you. It's easy to do, and it'll tell you a lot of information. If not, hang out for just a couple of minutes in the ED, and we'll show you, and then you can get a sense for where your patient is. Now, radiology, I do, again, I realize we're not taking pictures in the field, but this is something that's going to affect your patients, so I think it's important for us to understand. Any study that's needed, do it. We always talk about, well, you don't want to do any radiation to the baby that you don't need, and it's true. You don't want to do it if they don't need it. But if they need it, do it. And don't we waste way too much time going, well, there's a potential problem. I'm going to show you here why that's not really a problem anyway. But if you number one priority in the field and in the emergency department is helping, saving mom. And if we've got to do radiology to do that, then you've got to do that. That's how we're going to save the fetus. So please don't convince yourself that we got to avoid doing things that mom needs in any setting, in the pre-hospital or in the emergency department setting, if mom needs it. No, don't do routine studies. Hopefully we've gotten out of that mode anyway. Ultrasound is safe and easy. Can tell you a lot of stuff very quickly. DPLs are very reasonable to do. Some of you remember back in the old days, so to speak, we did DPLs all the time. We don't do them much anymore because of ultrasound. Pregnancy is very reasonable to do that in the right setting. That's how we can emphasize that. So organogenesis occurs at about the seventh week before we see any of these. Now, I want to emphasize this for a reason. We're often talking about, for trauma and pregnancy, the serious stuff is well beyond 20 weeks. So we're well outside of the highest risk situation to begin with. Number two is, less than 10 rads, which is how we measure radiation therapy, I won't get into a whole lot of detail with that, but is considered safe. Greater than 15 is a problem, particularly at 7 weeks, and a CT of the abdomen and pelvis is about 9. So although you never want to give unnecessary radiation, we're in very safe situations here, even in the worst setting, for getting a CAT scan. And again, I want to emphasize that, not because you'll necessarily be making the decision whether or not to CAT scan or not, but if you see that happening, that is why. We got to take care of mom. It is safe to take care of mom, and this is information we need to know. An operation is going to be just as dangerous to the fetus. So please be aware of that. It applies in the field with the same mentality. Whatever you need to do to take care of mom. All right, so I have a couple things just I want to throw in here before we get into some of the, what I think will be more, a little more difficult part of this, is some safety. This is pretty easy now. People have talked about, is there dangerous to seat belts? This is a pretty good study that came out of North Carolina in 2009 that looked at almost 2,500 patients and found that significantly less complications, both for mom and for baby, when both airbags and seat belts were used. So any of those debates that are out there still that say, are seat belts dangerous or not, please don't buy them. Seat belts are necessary. And if you get a chance for education, please tell them, use a seat belt. Use them as appropriate. Use both the lap belt and the shoulder belt, but please use the restraints. Another study showed unbelted or improperly restrained patients were twice as likely to bleed, moms were, and the fetus death was 3 times more likely when they were unrestrained for the same mechanism. A few other safety things for pregnancy. This is great. New Year's Eve, we had 4 pregnant patients with alcohols greater than 250. It's a different world. I will tell you this, though. I don't know everybody in this room personally. I know a lot of you, but I don't know everybody in this room personally. But I would say if we put IVs in all of us right now and gave us alcohol drips, which we can do because, I mean, it's kind of fun, but we actually have treatments where there's certain patients that get alcohol drips. If we did all that and got us up to about 100, we'd all be having a really good time. By the time we got to about 140, 150, I think most of us would be passing out and down. By the time we got 200, there'd be a lot of us in this room that would stop breathing. And yet here were 4 pregnant patients that were over 250. All right, that was different aside. If we can teach them maybe when they're young. So here is the biggest concern we have for trauma and pregnancy, and this is placental abruption. And this is essentially what's happening is the placenta is separating from the myometrium. Now, when you think about the size of the uterus, particularly as we get further along in pregnancy, a lot of bleeding can happen in that area. And when we talked about already how much blood is going to the uterus, this can be almost an entire blood volume, and you won't see it. Most common cause of fetal loss, and I want to emphasize that again, it's why we started off with that first comment, is this is how most of the babies die in pregnancy. For trauma. The easiest way to think about it is a potato chip in a tennis ball. If you throw that tennis ball much, hit it, do a whole lot, and the uterus is similar to a tennis ball. It's got a lot of flexibility in there. You're going to break that potato chip, right? Fairly easily. Exactly the same thing with the placenta. It doesn't take a whole lot of movement of the uterus to separate that placenta off and break it. But here's the problem. You're very unlikely to have any vaginal bleeding. You might have some abdominal pain, but as we talked about already, it's very likely that you will not. In fact, in one study, 78% of patients with placental abruption had no belly pain whatsoever. So think about that. You've had a relatively minor trauma. You've got no belly pain and no vaginal bleeding at all. How are you going to recognize when placental abruption is happening? The number one cause of fetal death. Unfortunately, you're not. Outside of ultrasound and sometimes very tricky ultrasound, and most importantly, cardiotrochographic monitoring for impact on the fetus, you're not going to know this. And so, please, big take-home point here is that minor trauma in pregnancy, particularly as we get later, beyond 20 weeks, can be very serious and you will not know it. You won't know it, mom won't know it. So please take it seriously. Now, there is uterine rupture or placental rupture. It is extremely rare. These are not the subtle ones. Now, the placental abruptions can be extremely subtle. Minor motor vehicle accidents, a fall from a standing position, even something so simple as a fall back on her buttocks can result in placental abruption. Placental rupture is very rare. That's going to be major mechanism, rollover motor vehicle accidents. These are not patients that are ever even thinking about not going to the hospital. Even in the setting of severe trauma, it's probably less than 1%. Most of these patients have a history of previous uterine scarring, a C-section, something like that, that has resulted in this. Again, usually significant mechanism, almost always in the third trimester. When this happens, this is a potentially deadly issue that needs to be taken care of immediately. So this patient needs to get to the trauma center now. I think that's going to be relatively obvious for most of these patients. The placental abruptions are the ones we need to think about more because that's not going to be as obvious. A few things on burns. Inadequate fluid resuscitation is the biggest problem we have in burn patients who are pregnant. Again, we seem to be a little hesitant to give them fluid. We shouldn't be. Baby's not going to mind it. Mom's certainly not going to mind it. Placental hypoperfusion is our biggest problem with burns and with other trauma. So please resuscitate them. Pain control is fine. We've run into this over and over again where we get worried about giving narcotics in pregnancy. Don't. There are lots of problems with a lot of drugs in pregnancy. Narcotics is not one of them. It's the safest one we can give them, short of Tylenol, and even then. So please, if they've burned, if they're in pain, give it to them. Fentanyl, morphine, whatever you've got, give it to them and be generous with it. Beware of carbon monoxide. We're always thinking about that in settings of burns and fires anyway, but realize that carbon monoxide preferentially binds to fetal hemoglobin. So, again, we lower our levels dramatically for mom to think about hyperbaric therapy. CPAP, I'm just going to throw that out there. That's the closest thing to hyperbaric therapy that we have, both in the field and in the hospital setting. Maybe very, very reasonable, give me a downside, to instituting CPAP when we're worried about it. But realize fetal hemoglobin is going to be much more sensitive to it. So again, in a setting where mom could look fine, even with that decreased respiratory status, still very dangerous to the baby. Electrical injury. Pregnant uterus is a very low resistance organ and area of the body. So as we talked about, remember when you go through the whole electrical injury talk, the low resistance areas get the electricity. That's where they go, where it goes. So an electric current passing through the uterus is very significant to the baby. And once again, mom may not notice much, but any sort of electrical exposure to the belly and or the uterus is going to be very significant for the fetus. And in fact, if there's even a very minor exposure, our protocol at Denver Health and most OB trauma patients are going to have at least 24 hours of cardiotrochographic monitoring as a basis. So realize again, low levels of electricity can be very dangerous. Domestic violence, unfortunately, we've all seen it. We've seen it in a lot of different settings. Anywhere from 10 to 30%, and this is scary, up to a third of women in pregnancy are victims of domestic violence, depending on the area and what study you read, but clearly a big issue. 5% are at risk for fetal death. 60% report multiple episodes of the trauma, and this is where we come in. So it's not just the episode we're seeing now, it's the future one. And we emphasize that. It's the same thing with child abuse, and you're going to have a talk next about some child abuse issues. But I worry about not only what I'm seeing there and what you're seeing, but you worry even more about the next one. Next one is almost always more serious. And in fact, we've got pretty good numbers to know next one had a higher rate of death. For the mom in this case, for the baby and child abuse, please realize how serious this is and take it very seriously. The uterus and fetus, amazingly enough, can often sustain the brunt of the trauma. Much of this is focused on the belly. When you think about it, unfortunately, a lot of the perpetrators are the significant others. And for whatever reason, they seem to focus a lot of their anger, whether they're blaming their whole situation on this pregnancy or for other reasons, they focus their anger on the belly. So once again, you might see a situation where domestic violence has come up and you won't see any obvious trauma as you might in the face or other areas in other situations. Realize that a lot of times in pregnancy, it is focused on the belly, where you won't see the same type of bruising. We're bad at detecting this too. So if there's anything that you run into in the field that makes you suspicious for this, please let us know. This is so serious for long-term outcomes, if not just for that episode, but for the future one. Please let us know. All right. This is the other time I'm going to take one hat off and suggest that you didn't hear this here, but I want to tell you this anyway. We're going to talk about emergency cesarean sections. The nature of our business, everything we do is focused on the fact that extreme situations call for extreme measures, right? Now, our job is to figure out when those extreme situations are, and usually we're pretty good about that. And if we take extreme measures when it's not an extreme situation, that's obviously very dangerous as well and very bad. But I'm going to tell you about one of the most extreme situations and talk about that for just a second. And that's when mom has suffered a fatal injury and is dying right there in front of you. So is the baby viable? You've got to consider that. If you have a viable baby and a dying or dead mom, you got 5 minutes before you've got a dead baby. Now, you may have it before that, but guaranteed, no baby is going to survive in a non-circulating mom for more than 5 minutes, which gives you about 4 minutes to try to resuscitate mom, and if you can't do it, gives you 1 minute to get the baby. Now, I realize we're talking to a situation here where if you go back and start to read in the scope of practice for the state, doing an emergency C-section in the field, you're not going to find it. But I will challenge you this, and this is where, again, I'm going to step back and say, you didn't hear it here, but we're going to talk about it anyway. Give me a downside. Give me a downside to getting the baby and a dead mom. The only guarantee you have is that mom without circulation for 5 minutes, baby's dead. It's a guarantee. Few guarantees in life, this is it. So in that rare situation where you have mom who is alive in front of you but dying, or at least has just died in front of you, you may be faced with this at one time in your career. And again, give me a downside. So I'm going to tell you how to do it, just in case. You need a knife and a scissors. And in truth, much like if you've ever had a talk on cricothyrotomy, I hope the first thing they told you about a cricothyrotomy is what's the most difficult part of that procedure? It's picking up the knife. It's not doing it. It's the decision to pick up the knife. Same thing here. This is an easy procedure. You can show anybody in this room how to do it in 3 minutes. This is not complicated. We're not worried about scarring or what else we're going to hit in the meantime. We got one relatively large object that we're going after, and we just need to get it. So at this point, it's pretty straightforward. You're going to do, just like in a cricothyrotomy, you're going to do a vertical incision. You're going to start above the umbilicus when you can. You don't have to. You can start right below the umbilicus. Vertical incision straight down to the uterus, and a vertical incision through the uterus. Takes you 30 seconds, even if you have no idea what you're doing and have never done this type of thing before. Takes you 30 seconds. So this is how they do. So C-sections, the vertical incision there on the left is what you're going to do when you once you get through the skin. It's one slice through the skin, one slice through the uterus. You want to try to be a little careful not to cut the baby when you go through that uterus. So you can take 5 seconds through the first incision, about 10 seconds through the next one. Pull the baby out. And then you get this. Now, I realize what I'm telling you is a big deal here. And I'm not suggesting that everybody go out and say, okay, we're going to write protocols on how to do C-sections in the field, and that this is going to be a common thing. But I do think when we're going to talk about this subject, we're going to talk about, and we are emergency providers, we're going to talk about the most extreme situation. And if, God forbid, you are ever in this situation in your career, I want you to think about today, right now, what you would do. And I've been in this situation 4 times. It's not fun. But I can tell you, of all the procedures I do in the ED, this is one of the easiest. Once I made the decision to pick up the knife, it was a simple procedure. The belly's right there. You can't miss it. And you're going to make a one incision in to get to the uterus, and it's right there. You can't miss it. And one more incision into the uterus to get to baby, who is also right there. Can't miss that. So I just want you to take a few moments and think right now, if you're ever in this situation where mom has died in front of you, what would you do? And it is absolutely, I'm not saying you should be doing this. That's for your medical director to decide. But I want you to take this time to think about what I would do, what you would do in that situation. And if you have the equipment, which is a knife, to do it, once again, give me a downside. I hate the terminology, but this is one of those where I'd far rather seek forgiveness than asking for permission, because you're never going to get permission from this standpoint. But give me a downside. You've got a dead mom. All you're going to have is a dead baby. Question?
Is CPR in a mother at that point, is it ineffective? Or can you do prolonged CPR to get to a hospital?
Yes, you can, but without any circulation after about 5 minutes, you probably lost baby, even in settings of CPR. So your question is it effective? And yes, it is in trying to maintain heart to the mom. But remember, fetal circulation is going to be compromised to help mom's circulation. Now, here's the wonderful / ironic part of all this. Taking the baby out of the uterus actually gives mom a better chance of responding to resuscitation than when the uterus is there. And there's a few reasons for this. It's not just the compression of the vena cava. It's in fact that the body understands this. Once baby's removed, body takes all the circulation away from the uterus and now concentrates 100%. Instead of 80% or 85%, it concentrates 100% on mom's circulation. So actually removing baby gives you the only chance to resuscitate mom in the worst settings, the only chance you might have. So it's a great question. What about doing CPR and just getting them to that standpoint? And you can potentially save mom. I would certainly suggest doing that, although in a trauma setting, CPR is not really where the issue is, right? I mean, we're bleeding, so the CPR is really not where it's going to help. But no circulation to the point where you're having to do CPR, 5 minutes, baby's gone. There is no exceptions to that. Hasn't been any. So again, in the setting where you've got mom that has just died in front of you, tell me where the downside is. I'm going to leave it at that. Yes?
Isn't the downside is if you waited a little past the 5 minutes and you got a vegetable that daddy has to take care of on limited income for the rest of the baby's life?
So the answer is yes. She talks about a very important issue, and the same thing that we deal with in resuscitation issues already. And I think that that's a big talk, and we've had some really good discussions on that issue as well. But that's why 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, that's exactly what you run into. Inside of 5 minutes, there's a very reasonable chance, if you can get that baby, that you can actually save that baby. Now, I'm not going to say there's no chance that that's what's going to happen. And I do think after 5 minutes, at that point, your risk is so high that I would not pursue it then. But that it's going to be on you. That's where the irony is. By the time you get to me with a dead mom, I'm almost at a point where I can't go any further. And so, I realize this is a big, big deal, but I'm going to say that if you're going to have any chance of saving baby, it's right away. And it's that decision to act right away. Yes, sir?
Isn't the real downside that even if I do this all right, everything works well, I'm probably looking for a new job in a new way?
So the answer to that is that's a very real concern.
Had that already happened?
Early 90s East Coast.
It has happened. So I'm not going to say for a moment that that's not an issue. And I'm not going to say for a moment that that's not something that we all have to consider in terms of what our job security is, which is why I'm going to say this is not something that I'm suggesting we go out and all do. But I will say this. I would defend this to any setting for any paramedic that I have any say over their practice. To the bottom line, if they look me in the eye and say, here was my situation, all I've got potentially is a dead mom and dead baby, I thought this was my only hope. And they had a situation where they knew enough to say it was a situation that was reasonable. Tell me how you can't defend that. Now, I realize that. There are some people who say, no, that's outside your scope of practice. But to me, that's simple-minded. And we are here to try to save people. And as naive as that may sound, this is one of the most extreme situations you're ever going to run into. And again, I'm not suggesting that you're doing this in the parking lot of your loved one trauma center just because you're at that five-minute mark. But there are some of you out here, I know, that are in some settings where you're 20, 30 minutes at best from a medical center. At best. And then maybe sometimes 4 hours. And you pull out a 38-week baby that you can then resuscitate, you get them there in time. Tell me that's not a pinnacle of your career, but tell me that's not also what we are here for. So, please again, please don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that we are incorporating protocols for doing C-sections in the field. All I want to do with this is put this in your mind to think about it now, because when a situation comes up, that's not the time to be thinking about what would I do or how would I do it. Think about now, what would you do? And if your answer is, look, I'm just too convinced that there's no way I would save my job for doing it, then you've got your answer. Maybe it's worth a discussion with your medical oversight now about something like that. But I do want everybody in this room that if they ever run into the situation in their career to at least have thought about it. And at least say, if I'm in a situation where I believe that's the right thing to do, at least I'll have thought about what to do in that setting. Or I'll have thought, I won't do it. And that's fine. Nobody is going to criticize you for not doing that in your setting. Nobody. So please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying you should do it, but I am saying you can do it. At least technically. All right. Now that I've left you with that point, turn to disposition. Based on the fetal monitoring, we're going to do this at least 4 hours for anybody who's viable. And that's even with minor trauma, so realize that out in the field. If anything is abnormal about that initial 4 hours in their monitoring, we're going to extend that to 24 hours at a minimum. Generally, there will be OB and surgery involved in that, in any OB trauma center. So let's go back to our case. So she got in there, and her ultrasound was positive. Now her repeat set of vital signs, her pulse was down a little bit. Remember, it had been about 120, and her pressure is 92. Now this is stable. This is normal vital signs for her level of pregnancy. But that's still concerning vital signs, right? I mean, we don't have a lot of room to grow there, particularly with that blood pressure. So we did a CT. She fell into that category of a positive ultrasound, but a stable patient for the moment. So we did a CT. We got a lacerated liver and spleen. Now, unfortunately, she dropped her pressure dramatically to about 60 in the CT scanner. So that bought her a trip straight to the OR. At which point they were able to, unfortunately, they removed their spleen, but they were able to repair her liver. But we're continuing the monitoring in the OR, fetal distress in the operating room. Remember, she's about 7 months. We were able to do a C-section, emergency C-section in the operating room, pull out baby, resuscitate baby about 5 minutes. Baby responded wonderfully. Mom and baby walked out of the hospital together 10 days later. Very nice setting, and in trauma and pregnancies, one of the good things is many of the times, as long as you recognize the dangers, good outcomes. Not always the case with all of our patients. In this case, a lot of them will be good outcomes if you can recognize the perils. So in summary, to finish up this, please take home point, no such thing as minor trauma in pregnancy. Even simple things like a fall from a standing position can result in fetal death if we don't recognize that. Normal findings in mom should not reassure us. We have to recognize what's normal and what's not, but realize that even when they're normal, that's not necessarily a good thing. Aggressive resuscitation is always warranted. Continuous cardiotrochographic monitoring for the baby is the key to managing these patients long term. Taking care of mom is always going to be the best way to take care of baby. Ideally, we will not see baby in this setting. Questions? Yes, sir.
Are they more prone to cervical spine injuries just due to the softening of their ligaments and
so the question is, are they more prone to cervical spine injuries? And there actually has been stronger arguments for they are somewhat protected against cervical spine injuries because of the focus of much of the trauma on the protuberant abdomen. But the answer is, there's no difference that we can find. No significant difference at all. Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention this morning.